Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotsuro,
the chef in the chapeau.
Terry Rotsuro, the chef in the hat. Yes, sir.
And KDO has ditched us this morning, so Sarah Leibovitz, our producer, is going to step in and be a grounding force.
That's
in,
right.
In our world of chefydom.
I'll try my best.
I'm chef owner of several of Seattle's finest restaurants, including the Dahlia Lounge, Etta's Seafood, Palace Kitchen, Lola, and the Carlisle Room. If you're going to the Paramount, check out the Carlisle Room. It's right across the street from the Paramount Theater. So it's always fun.
And I am the proud chef and owner of Luc in Madison Valley, a French-American bistro, and Lule downtown Seattle at the corner of 6th and Union. No snow there whatsoever.
I know. There isn't any snow downtown. Please, come downtown. Wasn't it ironic that on the day that the tunnel finally opened and we got rid of Via Gloom, that we ended up having our slowest day of the year by far with all the snow. So I think 9 of our 15 restaurants were actually closed on Monday. So
I must say something. I was open last night on both restaurants, and we actually did okay because all the other restaurants were closed.
I know you did okay because I went. I was at your restaurant last night with a party of 5.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
We tried to keep the bill under 5,000. Sorry.
How am I going to pay rent, Tom?
Yeah, exactly. We have a large show for you today. Sarah's going to sit in a bit for KDO. We're traveling back in time to learn about Seattle's food history with Judith Dern and her book, The Food and Drink of Seattle, From Wild Salmon to Craft Beer. We're going to taste some Valentine's treats with Dahlia Bakery manager Barb Parrott, sharing our favorite Valentine's meals. We're going to go toe-to-toe on food trivia also. And Sarah's going to play today, and we're going to kick her butt. Because Katie is always kicking our
butt. Afraid I wrote the questions, Tom.
Guess who's going to win?
Automatically disqualified.
All right.
You automatically win.
First, let's jump into a very romantic, ordinary to extraordinary. What do you have for us, Sarah?
That's right. So we're doing some more Valentine's Day-themed treats, such as steak. How would you prepare a great steak?
Well, to me, I think that a great steak is already a great steak. So to prepare it differently, just a little rub. Make sure your barbecue is very, very hot, because I would grill it outside. I did that this weekend when it was snowing. I was actually with my egg outside grilling beef chops.
Wow.
It was very impressive. And then I did some. But what I would do is focus on the sides, because I think that, you know, a steak is already, if you buy a great piece of meat, you already have that, and it's not that hot to grill. I mean, it's not that hot. You just obviously have to watch the temperature, but in most cases, you can grill a steak. Well, I think what's interesting is the side garnish is what you're going to do with it, which makes it more appealing. I grilled some fennel. Then I actually I marinated them in olive oil, salt, pepper, and some fresh thyme, chopped all around the fennel. And I left that on the counter for probably 3 hours. So it really and I kept moving it around in the bowl, so it kept macerating. So I grilled the fennel bulb. I did carrots, which is easy to do as well. Just make sure you have a little bit of, oil and salt and pepper, so they're seasoned. And when it's time for you to grill those vegetables, make sure there is no flame underneath, so there is no fume, no burning of the oil and soot flavor. But other than that, you can grill all kind of stuff. I grilled kale, carrots, fennel, and I did one more thing, but I can't remember what it is now. Tom, any other suggestions? And make a good béarnaise.
Aren't you going to do some sort of delicious starch to go with that potato?
Well, I did a mashed potato with celery root, a little bit of celery root. And the celery root is the time, this is the time where you want to buy that bulb that you're looking at, that big bowl, and you're looking in the vegetable section and have no idea what to do with it. Just peel it really well, cut it in small cube, and put it with your potato, and do 1/3 celery and 2/3 potato, and make a nice mash. Mm-hmm. And that makes a delicious flavor. Don't forget, it needs a lot of butter.
What doesn't?
Yeah,
what
doesn't?
So do I. I'm like a big baked potato. I need a lot of butter and some sour cream.
All the time.
That's right.
So if a good steak's always a good steak, how do you know, like at the grocery store, how to pick out a good one?
Well, there's a couple of things you can look at. And let's just say we're going to do it in New York, because that's my wife's favorite steak, is New York steak. So the big thing you want to check for is, number one, the grade, right? You want either choice or prime or Wagyu, something in that area. The higher the grade, the fattier the steak is, the less meat you need. And then let's face it, you don't want to have a 24-ounce steak on Valentine's if you're trying to be amorous and all those kind of things, right? It doesn't quite go together. Secondly, you want to look on a New York steak. There's two ends of it that you can cut from, right? And the one is called the nerve end, and the other is just kind of clear loin end of the New York steak. You always want to try and get from the loin end. The nerve end, if you're a well-done steak eater, then fine. Go ahead and buy the nerve end. But you're always finding in grocery stores and stuff that they're going to try and get rid of that nerve end first if you don't know better. So it's something to be smart about and to recognize. Look it up online. You can see what a nerve end looks like. So when it's there under the plastic wrap, you can be smart. And you are going to be a better cook by having the better steak without that tough nerve in the middle of your steak.
The nerve end stands for South Manhattan, because the New York steak is actually called a New York steak because it's shaped like New York. Did you know that?
The Manhattan
no,
Island.
Not at all.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say, chef is aggressive to be out grilling at this time of year.
Yes. I was aggressive, but I know I didn't want to do it.
I love it, chef. I bow down to you, but I'm telling you, it's also a time this time of year to maybe learn how to use your cast iron pan to get a beautiful crust on the outside of your steak, and then to learn how to rest properly. It's hard to get that same crust on a charcoal grill unless you got that baby cranked up. So
600
it's
degrees.
A good practice. It's good practice time in a nice cast iron pan to get a great crust on your New York steak.
Maybe don't practice on Valentine's Day, though.
Whatever. I mean, it's not much of a Valentine if she doesn't give you he doesn't give you a pass, or maybe overcooking the steak a little bit. But don't do it. You got a meat thermometer, right? We've told you a million times on this show to get a meat thermometer. Put it in the middle of your steak when it's at 115 or so, you've got a rare steak. When it's at 120, 125, you got a medium rare steak. When it's at 130, you got a medium steak. So just figure it out. Use your thermometer. And that reminds me, I have an apology to issue, which I'll show do the next segment. I got a nice little note from the health department about my chatter last week about chicken. So we will talk about that. We will talk about that in the next
segment. I can't believe they write to you. That's nice.
Oh, I get all kinds of mail. It's not usually, this was actually sort of nice. That you'd never eat at my house. we'll be right back with What's in Your Fridge. Let's make sure it's not rare chicken on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
And as I teased prior, I just wanted to take a minute. Last week's show, I talked about chicken and how I don't mind it a little pink towards the bone. I cook it to 145, let it rest to 150. Well, apparently the health department was listening to my show. And I also think I did put the words in their mouth saying that they would say that I should cook it over 155. And Miss Lori was very adamant that I should apologize to all of you, our faithful listeners, and tell them they should always cook their chicken to 165 or better. Mm. Okay, so that's the health department standard, apparently. And I did say last week that me personally, I didn't say our restaurants or anything like that.
Yeah, and you seem to have survived the catalyst of that. So, I mean, that's good.
It's interesting, you know, and she was right. I should be careful what I say out here about what I do personally, because I think people take sometimes, because we're chefs and stuff, they take us quite literally.
We also are more used to this kind of behavior since we've been practicing it.
it doesn't make it right or, it makes her right that's what the health department says, and
correct.
It doesn't make me wrong for liking it a little differently.
Right. Yeah.
But I just wanted to be clear.
Yes.
The health department says 165 or better. So I apologize to Lori and her team.
So, but it goes back to always what we say. Make sure you have a meat thermometer in your house.
Oh, that's the other thing she said, that I should have told people to use the thermometer. And I thought to myself, God, you're right. Because we always talk about that on this show, about that digital meat thermometer, right? Not one of those little ones with the dial. Get a digital one that it reads it fairly
Instagram
is what I want. And I don't know, chef, do you ever use those ones that you just point at the meat? Do they work?
No, because I don't know. I don't use them, so I don't know. We all don't have enough money to buy those $200 for every cook we have in the house.
Well, after me eating at your restaurant last night,
now we can
you
afford
can buy
it.
Six of them.
Perfect.
Just kidding. Okay, Sarah.
What's in their fridge that we can make a meal out of, particularly those with not much there? So the first person to respond, Cara Luca, had a pretty interesting little group of things. She had sunchokes, radishes, chicken legs, yogurt, and parsley.
Hmm. I know what I would do.
Me. Ooh. Go ahead. We're going to use that as a double version.
Cause right, really?
I think most people are not used to see, first of all, sunchoke is not on every day's menu on a daily basis.
Uh-huh. For good reason.
I'm not a fan.
I only like them fried. To me, there's not much worth in a sunchoke, like pureed or something gross.
So for those that don't know, what's the difference between like a sunchoke and an artichoke?
They're not related at all.
All right, good to know.
Sunchoke is a tuber, and artichoke is the thistle.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, they're very different.
And my wife could even be more specific than that because mm-hmm. she's a farmer. But.
And the sunchoke is a bit of a like discombobulated looking root kind of idea or tuber. And to peel, it's a little bit of a little chore. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of work for, you know, you got to like sunchoke.
Yeah.
But.
Anyway, so I was going to say, take the chicken legs and practice your knife skills. Just go ahead and take your boning knife or some sort of knife and release the meat and the skin as one big chunk from your chicken leg bone, right? Now now take your yogurt and add some delicious, your own curry powder or your own... So I keep that Ma Ploy red curry paste in my fridge. Mix that with your yogurt and then marinate your chicken legs, your boneless chicken legs skin on for at least a couple hours or overnight. And then I'm going to, when I'm ready for dinner, I'm going to saute or grill that chicken leg because the yogurt will tenderize it a little bit, mm-hmm. make it tangy and delicious. And especially if you use the red Thai curry, it's spicy. So you have these delicious little chicken legs, do a little spiced cardamom rice, and then take your sunchoke, slice it super thin, and deep fry it. So you have this crispy topping for your kind of creamy rice and chicken leg. And then garnish the whole thing with chopped parsley, because apparently you have a lot of parsley in your fridge.
That sounds lovely. Terry, what would you make?
I would confit the...
Let's go to another fridge.
I would cook the sunchoke in olive oil very, very slowly, like confit them. So they're really nice and tender, and you can use them as a garnish to your chicken, or you can also use it in a salad.
Very nice. All right, let's move on to, let's do Suzanne West's fridge. Suzanne has some very nice sounding things in her supposedly empty fridge. She has filet mignon, bok choy, lots of kale, sauerkraut with pickles, Parmesan cheese, and eggs.
Sauerkraut with pickles?
With pickles is what it says.
Huh.
Let's combine the two.
It wasn't sour enough. She had a pickle.
Yeah, you know. You're going to pickle one. Why not pickle all at once?
Well, pickling is so popular. Like sauerkrauting is fermenting so popular right now that I wouldn't be surprised to see that combo.
So what are you going to do with that beautiful combination of things, Chef Terry?
So I think that definitely lots of kale. I would definitely take those kales and put them in the oven and roast them. Season with just a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, and then roast those leaves so you have the whole bunch of kale already taken care of. That means your oven is already on. Bok choy I would steam. So you have a steamer on the fire and you just steam your bok choy. Finish them with a little bit of soy, sesame oil, toasted sesame oil. Keep it very simple. And then for the leftover sweet potato, I make a little cake. And then breadcrumb or panko. And then do a little sweet potato cakes. Then you would use as a garnish to the filet mignon, which the filet mignon itself I would just... So I'm not a big fan of filet mignon, so salt, pepper, keep it as simple as possible, brown butter in the pan, make your medallion not too thick, and then, you know, maybe an inch, and then pan sear that filet mignon in sauté pan with brown butter, and then keep basting your filet mignon on both sides. You'll have a wonderful, tasty, nutty filet mignon on your hand.
So your sweet potato is like a croquette then?
Yeah, like a croquette, exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. And then you do it in the pan with a little bit of olive oil. Not too hot, but not too cold. Obviously, you don't want it to start cold. And then you fry your sweet potato cake right on the side, and then you put your filet mignon with that, your roasted kale, and then what else does she have? She has, the sauerkraut. I would just warm that up and put that on the side because that creates that beautiful pickling, you know, sour pickling that you have to match against the filet mignon and the potato cake, the richness of both of those. And, you know, once again, I'm going to use the word béarnaise twice today. I would do a nice little béarnaise because it's a classic, but it's also a very nice tarragon white vinegar kind of bite to go through the filet mignon. So that's delicious garnish.
All right, we've got 2 minutes. Let's see if we can hit one more fridge in that time. And let's go ahead and do Chris Innes's. Chris has pad thai noodles, mung beans, thin sliced beef, lime juice, and soy milk. And a note to pick up a steak, he says. Not quite as useful for us.
He's got a Thai beef salad, or she. I'm not sure if it's a he or she, but has a Thai beef salad waiting to happen, mm-hmm. which is just the noodles. I'd pick up, while you're picking up the steak, pick up a little green papaya and just shred your green papaya. Get some shallots and deep fry the shallots until they're kind of bittersweet chocolate color. not quite that dark, but, you know, golden, dark golden brown. And then just put all these things together, and you have a beautiful, beautiful...
noodle beef salad.
Thai beef salad, or mm-hmm. with mok chom, and all the lime juice and fish sauce and blah, blah, blah. And if you're really feeling it, you can take your soy milk, I think, and possibly make your own tofu.
Oh, wow. Ooh, that's a process,
that
isn't it?
Yeah, that was. But that is not something you do with leftovers. That's a,
and a whole bunch of cilantro chopped on top of that.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And I will say, Terry, back to your filet. I don't order filet either, but for some reason I was in Manhattan this last weekend, and I was at one of the most expensive restaurants that I've ever gone to called The Grill. And we they were out of their steak that we wanted, so Keith, our my cohort, and I shared the Chateaubriand, bone-on Chateaubriand.
Oh, wow.
$300 for our steak.
Wow.
And, you know, to your point about the filet, like, if you're not going to butterfly the filet and get some more serious brown instead of all that interior raw meat,
yeah.
This thing came out. It must have been about a pound and a half, something like that, with the bone. And, you know, you're just eating a big pile of raw beef, right,
yeah.
outside
yeah.
the crust.
Yeah.
So it's not my favorite cut of the order.
It's good. It's a great meat to do tartare with, beef tartare.
Yes. Okay. Over a year ago, Leslie Kelly set off to travel the country and eat her way from coast to coast. And now she's back to tell us about her foodie adventure so far. To be continued on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Hey, it's the Seattle Kitchen Show, and you're in it on Cairo Radio from the Hot Stove Society here in downtown Seattle. Thank you for joining us. You know, we're on every Saturday and Sunday, except when we're not. And we are always podcastable. So all the way back to, Tina, how long? Just give me a hand count. How many years can you
maybe
podcast?
Six years
you can go back.
At very least.
Yeah, pick up some of our witty conversations.
What happened to the other 10 years behind that? Is it with no podcast back then?
Okay. No, it's all lost. It's all lost to terrestrial history.
You can only buy that, like, on eBay. It's really expensive.
Yeah.
Go buy it.
It's under Rub With Love, Terry and Tom. let's see. Leslie Kelly is here. Welcome back.
Thank you.
To Seattle, hello, and to the
hello,
show.
Hello, hello. Good morning.
It's good to have you back. You look happy and healthy.
I am so happy.
Mm-hmm. You have a little tan.
I've been swimming outside.
Really?
Yeah, at the Rose Bowl Aquatic Center in Pasadena for the last couple months.
Do you park your camper there or something? How do you get in there?
Yeah, you can park your camper there, but I've been house sitting for my sister in Pasadena, so I had a little bit of time out of the van.
I feel like that's cheating.
It is not. I write the rules, so it is. What?
As you go.
How is it cheating?
As you go.
Tell folks about your trip.
Well, we actually we sold our house in Queen Anne and bought a 23-foot RV, took off in late September and headed east and south. We've hit around 20-something national parks mm-hmm. and monuments and all kinds of incredible scenery. We chased the fall leaves. We went to Ketchum, Idaho. That was a real wonderful surprise. And then Craters of the Moon, Dinosaur National Monument. Went back to Colorado, where we had lived when we were young and in love. And my husband of 37 years or some damn thing. Went to Aspen. I've just been everywhere. And then spent the last couple of months hanging out in California, my home state,
mm-hmm.
and exploring the state parks there. We just camped at a beautiful state park near San Diego, up on a bluff overlooking the ocean, watching the surfers. We're just living the dream until we're kind of living the nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
But
of being out of funds.
There's that. We don't even want to look at the bank account. But it's been a great adventure. We've just made a lot of delicious discoveries along the way. I have started writing for Forbes.com, so I am doing some fun reporting on the road. I went and ate a whole bunch of burgers around L.A., and that was fun. So it's been a blast.
Have you found a book yet?
Oh, who writes books anymore? Sorry, Judith. But I think the story is still unfolding.
Yeah.
And when I meet back up with
my husband, John, in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 3 weeks. We're going to head to Texas, and then we're going points south and east and doing the rest of the country, and then we'll be back here in the summertime and figure out maybe if there's a book in
what's,
it.
What's next?
Yeah.
Don't forget the barbecue belt. I know you won't.
Oh, no. I'm all focused on the barbecue, too. I'm going to go to Austin, Texas. It's been a very filling and fulfilling adventure. Uh-huh. So
you know, Austin didn't used to be in the belt until Franklin's opened up. Really.
I know. Right. Yeah.
But, it's very funny.
It was always like an hour, hour and a half south of Austin, that whole strip of great barbecue joints.
So I just talked to Aaron Franklin, interviewed him for a story I'm doing on fun festivals that are a little bit under the radar. And have you heard of Hot Luck?
Uh-uh.
Okay, he's got a festival in May called Hot Luck, and it's kind of like he's modeled it on, the backyard barbecue that you want to go to, you know? So he brings in chefs from around the country, and they do fun, you know, smoked meats and cocktails and bands playing, and it sounds like a blast.
Hmm, fun.
Probably Willie Nelson.
Willie Nelson, I'm sure. Why not?
He lives in Austin, right?
So you've been all over the place. You've brought us something today, I'm sure, from your travels.
Well, this was one of those delicious discoveries that I made. We were hanging out in New Mexico, in Raton, New Mexico, which is a little obscure town in northeast New Mexico. And I was, you know, one of the things I love to do is go to the grocery stores and just, you know, take a look at what's new and different. They had at this grocery store where I found this green chili dip, they also had beef feet for sale. I've never seen that before.
That's a lot of food.
I've only seen it as dog chews.
I mean, I know it was in the freezer with the rest of the edibles. I mean, edible offals, I guess. And so this green chili dip, I'm like, I'm going to try it. It's basically French onion dip, but with roasted Hatch green chilies swapped in for the onion soup
mix. It's got great flavor.
Thank you. Really? I topped it with a little bit of Rub With Love smoked paprika.
Oh, of course you did.
Yeah. So
it reminds me a little bit of pimento cheese, which is more of a kind of a Georgia, Alabama thing,
it's
probably,
definitely a southern thing, and I love pimento cheese. You know who has great pimento cheese here is Eduardo at June Baby.
Does he?
Yeah. Oh, it's the best.
I'll have to try it.
Yeah.
I'm pretty proud of ours at the Brave Horse Tavern, too.
Oh, yeah. Brave Horse does great pimento cheese and many other things.
So when I go on and look, Terry, I don't know if you've noticed this, but on some of the travel channels, you know, apparently millennials love, and I'm being general, don't write me a letter, it's just generalization, they love RVing.
Is that
camping.
Right? Well, van life is van life. Hashtag van life. Is
well, because
the
they're young.
There's TV shows all about it now.
Yeah. I mean, it is.
They haven't discovered the full season yet.
I mean, you go up to Alaska, I was up in Homer, and there's RVs everywhere with all these youngsters in them.
I mean, I think it is part of the adventure to go, because you can change your scenery all the time. We were also up in Alaska. We were in Seward. And in Seward, there's a city park that is just filled with RVs and fishing boats. And it's kind of a fun, festive atmosphere. I did not see a lot of millennials. I have not run into that. Right now, I think it's really about the snowbirds. We're seeing people with huge rigs. I mean, I'm talking about rock star tour buses who go and park for a long period of time, you know.
They have a $250,000 RV and they park in a Walmart parking lot.
No.
They just want to be there when it opens.
So
that's because don't they have like free dump facilities?
Let's not talk about dump facilities right now. But that's a chore still relegated to my husband. Thank you very much. But I've really learned to do some fancy footwork in the teeny tiny kitchen. I'm learning to do things in a whole different way, which means I have to actually clean up after myself, and that's crazy. But back to...
So lots of one-pan dish.
One-pan dishes, yeah, and using my grill pan. I heard you guys talking about grill pans and cooking outside whenever possible. One of my greatest triumphs so far is cooking breakfast for dinner over the campfire at Dinosaur National Monument. It was just spectacular with Bavarian meats bacon. I took some, you know, things that would remind me of Seattle, and so that was really fun. But back to the trend of RVing and van life. It is like, if you look on social media, if you look on Instagram, hashtag van life, it is huge. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely huge. And some of those situations are a little scrappy. Like, there's no bathroom, and that, I'm sorry, I gotta have a bathroom. Mm-hmm. So ours is pretty short. It's 23 feet, but it's pretty comfy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got everything I need, and it's taught me to live in a little more organized way, if that's possible.
Mm-hmm. It is possible when you're pushed to it.
Yeah, when you're forced. Yeah.
The any books that you would recommend that have helped you through the van life kitchen? Is there like an RV? The Pioneer Woman Does RVs or something like that?
No. I'm making it up as I go along. But back to the organization, I did start watching the Condamari Netflix feature, and it's kind of like Hoarders meets Let's Get Organized, you know. And I've taken some tips from that, and you know, it's all just really a work in progress. But if y'all are anywhere down the road in on the Eastern Seaboard or in New Orleans or in Florida this spring, hit me up and maybe I'll cook some food for you in my RV.
We'll put your website on our Facebook page.
Yeah, sounds good.
And we'll.
It's fantastic.
People can meet you on the road and use your bathroom and your kitchen.
I didn't say that.
All right, that's Leslie Kelly, former reviewer for the Seattle PI, and also used to work at All Recipes, and it's just general spokesman review, the Memphis Gazette.
Memphis Commercial Appeal.
Yes, but just an all-around great foodie from our little town of Seattle. On the road. Up next, Lloyd Glasscock is going to be here on Skype, apparently. He's with the Northwest Flower and Garden Show, which starts on the 20th and goes through the 24th at the Convention Center. On Camera Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
You certainly are, sir, and I had a delicious dinner at your restaurant, Lule, last night.
Oh, bless your soul.
Yes, indeed.
You finally visited my restaurant.
I spent my allowance for the week.
Uh-huh. And the month. I hope.
I'm Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's restaurants here in Seattle, and we're going to be at the Garden Show in a couple of weeks, and we're hoping that you'll come by and use our secret handshake to get something free from our booth.
What is the handshake?
So, Sarah, do you remember what I said last week was our secret handshake?
I do indeed, because it's Richard Nixon's double peace signs.
Makes that's
it
right.
Easy to remember. Yeah,
exactly. But didn't you have to say something, too? Like, I heard you on...
It was HSSSK, so Hot Stove Society, Seattle Kitchen.
Those are the letters you have to say, and you have to give me a double peace sign, because I'm all about peace.
Exactly.
Peace in the world.
What do you win?
I haven't decided yet.
Okay.
Depends on how many people
it's
come by
mystery.
My booth.
Yeah.
If it's one person, it's a big prize.
There you go.
If it's a lot.
Don't tell anybody else.
Exactly. Because of that, because we're going to be there from the 20th through the 24th, we thought we'd ask someone from the Garden Show to come on and tell us about how that massive production gets done and why it's so darn cool. You walk through the door and you're blown away by the efforts that have gone on there. So Lloyd Glasscock is here. He is... a producer there at the Northwest Flower and Garden Show, and he's on Skype with us today, which we rarely have done before, if ever. Hi, Lloyd.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fabulous.
Are you getting excited, or are you resting up?
Well, you know, by this time, my job down there is to walk around and point more than anything. It's the garden creators that we have down there. We have about 20 of those down there this year. And so we'll have 20 garden creators, and they're the ones right now, especially with this horrible weather we're having, that are probably a bit more antsy than I would be right now. Although, candidly, when you see snow and ice, it does not bode well for move-in. So that's more of a challenge that I want to deal with. And that's weighing on our brains a little bit right now. To be fair.
You know, so much of what is happening down there is all forced plants. Does this weather kind of stop that in its tracks, or are they all in greenhouses and already being forced?
The forcing program is great because that stuff's protected. It's the stuff that people, you know, we had a very mild January, right? So it was like no rain in the warmest January in years. And so the material that was out in the field may have been a little soft. And right now in Arlington, I live in Arlington, it was 18 degrees, I think, last night. Maybe in some areas it got down to 14. And that's really hard on the new plant, new shoots on plant material. So folks that thought, hey, I got my plant set, I got this set, and didn't bring it in under protection, they may be sweating it a little bit. Now, the good news is we got lots of snow on top of that stuff, and snow is a great insulator, so we'll hope that helps that. But a lot of the stuff, there is a good forcing program. Our color will be okay. Stuff being shipped from other areas will be okay. I think it's going to be a beautiful show, of course. We did change the name of the festival a few years ago, Northwest Flower and Garden Festival, so that we have to get in the mode to calling it that. Even we have been with the show for a long time, keep forgetting to do that. But yeah, we're looking forward to it, and it'll be beautiful. And the weather, hopefully, knock wood, is not going to be an issue for us.
Going to warm up a bit. You know, it's a huge show, and
sometimes
you don't know where to start. What are some of the most popular things to do at the Flower and Garden Festival?
Well, we have the seminar program, which we have, once you give your ticket costs you $24, I think, regular, and I think like 20 bucks if you buy it ahead of time. And we, that gets you into all the things that are at the show. And so we have the show feature gardens, which are huge and probably the number one thing people go to the show for. We have seminars, and we have like 100 seminars on just about any gardening topic you can think of. And those seminars, about 20 per day, I guess it is, those are also included with your ticket price. You don't pay any more for that stuff. And then we've got exhibitors if you're going to go shopping for plant material or garden items or even artwork. A big part of the show is art. We have food vendors there, so that which is fun to do. And there's just... you can spend the day there easily. I always tell people, well, you're going to spend, $20 a ticket anymore to go to the movies. You can just spend your $20 a ticket to the Flower and Garden Show, and you could be there for 10 hours. So it's really, really a lot to see and do. Yeah.
And with your ticket stub, you can get a discount at any of our restaurants. But just a little plug.
Hey, that's right. That's right. I heard about that. Yeah.
Tell me about Container Wars. This sounds exciting. I've gone to the Flower and Garden Festival.
Wars.
Many times. I've been a booth there. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be a food booth there this year with our Rub with Love line. What is Container Wars?
Well, Container Wars is we had a garden, a feature called Garden Wars a few years ago. And in Garden Wars, we had these plots that people, teams of three, had to head-to-head make a nice landscape in like an hour. In Container Wars, what we've done is we've taken that big landscape away because, candidly, it was a bit cumbersome to put it together each day of the show. In Container Wars, they've got this menu of plant material, if you will, much like the pantry in Chopped, right? And so they come in and the food show. And they come in and they've got three containers they need to build. The designer has three containers they have to create head-to-head against another designer doing their containers, and they've got I think 45 minutes or so to do these three containers with whatever is there to work with. They can't bring their own plant material. They got to work with what's there. And it's a fun gig, and it really shows you how to put a planter together quickly. There are times when the competitors are cramming material into the container so hard that you wonder about the survivability factor. I think one of the people last year tore the rip ball off of one of the things because he just wanted the green part of the plant in the container. So, but it is competitive. It is fun. And most of the competitors in that are actually give seminars from the seminar stage down throughout the show. So those folks doing seminars, there's two folks per day that normally give a seminar. They come up and also participate in the garden, the Container Wars, which it is a lot of fun to watch. And I believe the audience is the ones that, yeah, cheer for one side or the other, and that declares who your winner is.
So, Lloyd, if I only have an hour to go to the flower show, let's say I'm downtown, I have an hour to wait for traffic to clear up, and I just want to go to the flower show to kill some time, for say, what would be the first exhibition you would go through? There's got to be a couple, like, really top-notch exhibition. What would you pick? What are they?
Well, as soon
and you
as
have
you
to tell us in a minute,
because
we only have a minute left.
No worries. As soon as you come in the front doors, the theme garden hits you right in the face with beautiful color. Big, we're taking you to Ireland and Scotland with this theme garden this year. So you're going to see that. And as soon as you start walking around the garden floor, that's where you're going to want to hit first. And I guarantee you lose that hour of time before you know it. And who knows, that 1 hour may have turned into three by the time you got off the garden floor, because there's so much to see.
All right. That's Lloyd Glasscock. The Flower and Garden Festival is starting Wednesday, February 20th through Sunday, February 24th. It's 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Wednesday through Saturday and 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Sunday. And we'll be there the whole time. I'm actually going to miss the first day, the 20th, but I'll be there the rest of the week for the whole show. Cooking away, Rub with Love. And we actually have an interesting hot stove event at this year. We're going to have a little some burners set up with some pans, and we're going to teach you how to saute at the Flower and Garden Festival.
Wow.
That's on Cairo Radio. Thank you, Lloyd.
Super. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. See you at the show. It's Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. We'll be right back with our favorite Valentine's meal on Cairo Radio. We are back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio. We've got another whole hour of our show. It's time to tell you that you can't leave us until we finish with the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia, our last hour. Judith Dern is going to be here. She's the author of Food and Drink of Seattle. We've got, who else, Sarah?
We've got Barb Parrott of the Dahlia Bakery is going to come and show us all of their Valentine's Day treats that they've got.
Do we get to eat them?
Yes, we
They're
do.
Actually
she's
made?
She's bringing them with her.
Awesome.
I know.
And then we're going to talk a little bit about our favorite taste of the week. And this show is produced, by the way, by Large Media, L-A-R-J. Both Tina, Sarah, and Sean are all part of that team, and we appreciate you.
Well, thank you very much.
Indeed. Every week.
All right, Terry, what are you going to make for Kathy for Valentine's Day?
Well, I know what I'm going to make for dessert, because she's got a little sweet teeth.
Yeah.
Or tooth, I should say. But all of them are sweet. And I think I'm going to try to make a little croquembouche, because that's how I met her, and that's how I wowed her the first time I met her.
That's how you won her over?
Yeah.
Really?
How many boyfriend or girlfriends have made a croquembouche for you?
Never.
Exactly.
I think my wife made one, but that was 20 years after we were married.
Yeah, so the third time I went out with Kathy, I think I made a croquembouche for dessert.
How did you end up?
And she was like, oh my God. That was a nice little croquembouche.
Yeah.
That was a lot of work, especially making this kind of stuff at home. It's a little bit of a...
You were at her home and made it?
Yeah.
On the third date?
Yeah.
What did she do?
Wow, you were a mover.
She almost fell over.
Yeah, you're a mover.
The first day I met her, I cleaned the fridge, and she was like, I got to keep this guy.
Okay.
I opened the fridge. I was like, what the heck is this? I had to empty the fridge and clean it because it was gross. So
I have a similar story, but not quite the same. When I first met Jackie, she couldn't drive her car because she hadn't paid any of her parking tickets. So I went and paid her parking tickets, and because I didn't have a car. So it's like, this is ridiculous. It's like 37 years ago, it was $400 worth of parking tickets.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Where do I find these men?
Where do you find these men?
Yeah, where do I find these men?
We are very rare, Sarah.
You know what? They don't make them like that no more.
Yeah. The online dating doesn't give those kinds of results, I got to say.
So anyway, I would say that it is, because it's Valentine's Day, you need to focus a little bit on one special item. It could be an entree, an appetizer, or whatever. But I think a little Dungeness crab salad with some avocado, some grapefruit, and maybe make the entree so then you can have a good time and not stress for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Make it safe. So, you know, I would go between a roast chicken if you have a little practice in the kitchen, or I would even go to as simple as a steak. You know, I mean, as simple, it's not necessarily simple, but as easy as a steak, basically.
You know what would be good on that salad? If you want to make that salad an entree salad, take some of that Spanish chorizo and kind of make little tiny batons and crispen it up on top of that bib lettuce, the crab, the grapefruit, and then use some of the chorizo fat to make a vinaigrette, right? For over top of all that.
Most importantly, it's not Thanksgiving. Make sure you keep it light. Don't make it too heavy, because you don't want to hand up the dinner and go, I'm dead now. Gotta
GD, go home. GTGL. Just remember that. And when you figure
great
it out,
technique.
Great life.
There you go.
Yeah. That was it.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, Tom, what are you going to make?
I'm making mooshu duck.
Ooh,
I think
that's
cool. Like if Valentine's and things like that, I think it's romantic when you can eat with your hands.
Uh-huh.
So mooshu duck, you just make these, you know, very fresh little flour pancakes, really thin, like thinner than a tortilla even, is when they're best, in my opinion.
Griddle do you lightly. Roll them or do you buy them already?
I roll them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very simple to make. And then I just take a whole roasted duck, but it's roasted well done all the way, and then I shred it with my fingers. I take the skin off and crisp the skin, so that's an ingredient, the crispy skin, the shredded duck, the some sort of rehydrated mushroom, either rehydrated shiitake or wood ear mushroom, something like that, shredded carrots, shredded cabbage, a little bit of fried egg, kind of all crumbled up into this mix, and then some slivered onion. And take that whole thing, put a super hot wok. So you got your wok going, you got the peanut oil in there, and you're going to take that mix just one handful at a time. You can do a couple, multiple, you know, tries in the wok, but you don't want to overload your wok.
Right.
Because then you end up with steam mooshu instead of hot seared mooshu. So now I've got my delicious filling. I've got my little pancakes. All I need now is a little, I love that kunchang.
Oh, crispy chili.
No, not crispy chili, although that would be perfect.
Yeah, that would be perfect.
But kunchan hoisin sauce.
Oh, yeah.
So you take your pancake, you kind of spread it with hoisin sauce, which is basically Chinese ketchup made from fermented mung beans. Super delicious, a little bit sweet. You put the filling in there, you wrap it up, and then you play Lady and the Tramp.
It's the dream.
It's the dream.
You're missing the noodle.
Yeah, I don't need the noodle part.
Get a pancake instead.
It was the funniest thing. I was just in Manhattan, and I went to David Chang's New Bang Bar, and he makes these kind of roti, spicy pork sandwiches, and it's a big roti, maybe 14 or 15 inches oblong by 12, and then he puts meat on both sides and leaves the center of the sandwich undone, and then he rolls it up and so that he can then fold the sandwich into like a U-shape. And that's how he serves the sandwich. And right next to us, these two people were playing Lady and the Tramp. They each took a side, literally, over a table, right next to us, and they ate it together at the same time until they met at the middle and then started making out.
That seems like the messiest version of Lady and the Tramp that you could do, just like bits of sandwich falling out.
Yeah.
Well, it's the tramp part of the lady.
How do you start making out when you got a mouthful of pork sandwich?
No, you know exactly what's just been in your mouth, and it's not.
Anyway, it was pretty darn funny. I quite enjoyed it. It was like a show with my sandwich.
Yeah. So you've got that taken care of. But anything else? Any salad? Any dessert? Any cheese? Any
mooshu's, is a big dessert night.
Mooshu kind of has the salad in it. You know, it's the cabbage.
Yeah, it's very
vegetable heavy. So for dessert, what should we do? A little mango sorbet with some coconut macaroons or something like that.
That sounds good.
Are you making your sorbet? Or are you going?
Of course, I have a recipe. You know, I happen to be an author. I know, Sarah, you haven't ever purchased one of my books.
I've never read a book
but
before.
If you look in the Dahlia Bakery cookbook, you might find a recipe for mango sorbet and coconut macaroons.
Oh, that's perfect.
And if you buy my book, I get 5 sorbet in there also. So just saying.
Yeah, I've got some options. Is what you're saying.
Hate for you to research your host at all. Okay, time for Judith Dern. She's the author of The Food and Drink of Seattle, kind of a verbal history, some pictures of what went on here for many, many years. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen at the Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM on your dial. It's the Hot Stove Society where we take, and we are here with Judith Dern. She has a book out fairly new called The Food and Drink of Seattle. From wild salmon to craft beer. And we sat for an interview for this, maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago?
Yes.
It was super fun.
Yes.
And I said to you, I'm not sure that this is the kind of book that's going to sell. How's it doing?
As far as I can tell, it's doing quite well.
Awesome.
It helps to have author appearances.
Yeah, does it?
I appreciate being here, so thank you.
And have you done a few of these around the country?
No.
Or you're just doing
Seattle? I've just done Seattle.
Okay.
Yes. It's part of a series that the publisher has done.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's right. I knew there was some connection to that. It's so fun. You know, being 60 years old now, not only am I looking for cemeteries, but I am one of the few left that remembers the Seattle food scene from 50 years ago or 40 years ago. I guess I got here 41 years ago. So it's fun to see some of the references in here to some of the restaurants when I first got here, like the Golden Lion at the Olympic Hotel. That was one of the places where I used to go see jazz and eat prime rib. It was super fun. And there's a lot of places like that that aren't remembered around this town anymore. Certainly Victor Rossellini's places and fun things like that. So I want to say you wanted to focus a little bit today on how immigrants have changed the Seattle food scene.
Immigrants have been here from the beginning.
Yeah.
They came for the jobs in the lumber industry, in the maritime industry, canneries, fishing, you name it.
Railroad.
Absolutely. Railroads were instrumental in getting people here.
Mm-hmm.
The first railroad ended in Tacoma, so it took them 10 years to build the extension to Seattle.
Is that right?
But it happened in 1893.
It seems like the problem seems to be reoccurring. Sounds very familiar.
I think we just approved funds for that.
you could say that, yes. But people came here for jobs. There was the 1862 Homestead Act gave people land. Mm-hmm. They could get 160 acres, and that drew a lot of immigrants from Europe. And then other people came as the economy suffered in their home countries. Mm-hmm. They came to work. And it was interesting to go back through the history and see that when the Chinese came, there were different laws that all of a sudden it's like, no, you can't come anymore.
Uh-huh.
And then before World War II, there was another law that said people from Eastern Europe couldn't come. But certainly the groups that have come have been instrumental in building our culinary history, both past and present.
Interesting.
Yeah, it seems like it's always how it starts. Somebody comes from somewhere else and go, have you guys tried this before? You know, you're showcasing what you have at home, what you're missing. You know, often Tom refers to soldiers coming back from wars and, you know, kind of like going, well, I was in Vietnam, I had some banh mi, I want to eat some banh mi. You know, it's like suddenly banh mi becomes something.
Food is definitely a cultural connection.
Oh, absolutely. But,
and then in 1896, there was a shipping line established between Seattle and Asia, which meant that all of a sudden they could bring in the authentic foods ingredients, and that really boosted the Chinese and Japanese grocery stores, restaurants. They were mostly in Pioneer Square.
Mm-hmm.
And moved out from that area. But the Japanese, the Italians were also important as truck farmers, and that supplied both markets in the city and Pike Place Market.
Mm-hmm.
When it started.
They kind of started that, right? The truck farmers did, because
yes.
They were upset
yes.
at the middlemen that were gouging.
Exactly.
Gouging people.
Yes.
Yeah.
1907 is a landmark.
Oh, interesting. Native cuisine doesn't seem to have survived a whole lot. And nor was it probably very hard to accomplish, right? You know, dried salmon or preserved berries or something like that. Is there any sort of native cuisine left?
Not that much.
Mm-hmm.
They are also, the native people are trying to revive it among their own people,
mm-hmm.
which has been interesting to see. Food is, again, the connection.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was interesting is a lot of the Asian cultures that came here, it included ingredients that were local. I mean, they would start using Dungeness crab. They would start using salmon.
Uh-huh.
So there was an interpretation using local ingredients.
Well, it's a lot more efficient and a lot fresher to use local ingredients than using anything brought into town.
Yes.
Are you saying then that when the white settlers came from the east, that they weren't using those ingredients, that it wasn't a natural connection to their own foods?
Not initially. They wanted bread. So they, until the wheat fields got established in eastern Washington, a lot of the flour was brought in by ship,
mm-hmm.
and things that were familiar came by ship, and that gradually changed as eastern Washington was cultivated.
Interesting.
And the railroads again brought it over the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get a little bit more recent in the 60s and 70s in the Seattle restaurant scene. I got here in 77. And there was a prolific kind of a classic American restaurant scene, whether it was Ivers or Rossellini's, you know, typical kind of red sauce American-Italian food that you might have found in South Philadelphia or that nature. There was the King Oscar's and places like that that had steak with crab on top and sauce. What did you find when you did your research about kind of mid-century food in this, or mid-last century, I guess it is now. But
I thought it was interesting that the Greeks managed and owned about 75% of the restaurants in Seattle in the 1960s.
Uh-huh.
They weren't necessarily serving Greek food that we think of authentic, but they had adapted menus to what was American.
Right.
So that was pretty much the standard.
Yeah, there used to be one at 5th and right across from Dahlia over there. There used to be, block from Dahlia. There used to be a diner there.
Steve's Broiler was
a Greek. Yeah, Steve's Broiler.
He was a Greek and was very well known. He had a 24-hour restaurant right there across the street.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
They didn't survive the 60s. I think what did happen was there was a whole teriyaki phase. Seattle became well known for that in the 70s, and one restaurant spawned several others as people set up their own franchises.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing about restaurants, you know, and that's why you see so many of them, and that's why they come and go so quickly, because the cost of entry is fairly inexpensive. When you look at, you know, you could open a business tomorrow for $100,000, a teriyaki joint, for $100,000, you know. To sustain that with your rent and your labor after that is where it becomes more difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I know in 2015, the Huffington Post did a survey, and it found that the restaurants in Seattle that were most popular were Japanese, Vietnamese, Korean, and Chinese, and that was very different than the rest of the country.
Oh, is it really?
Yes.
I didn't realize that. That it just seems like everywhere you go, it's filled with Asian food of some sort or another.
And it's become more authentic. I mean, we have Vietnamese. You can find Vietnamese pho and teriyaki side by side.
Yeah. Right.
When I took Martin Yan through, of Yan Ken Cook, I took him through our Chinatown a few years back. He just was marveling at what an old Chinatown that we had. It has even changed since we did that maybe five or 8 years ago. But he just said, this is a historic old Chinatown compared to the new Chinatown down in L.A. or someplace where there's more modern immigration, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, you can. You can still go there and find the real thing.
You can. And if you go to the Wing Luke Museum, you can really find it. They even institutionalized a grocery store, Waiyang Grocery, that I used to shop at myself. So super fun. Well, Judith, thank you so much. If you want the book, read more about the history of Seattle's wild salmon to craft beer. It's called The Food and Drink of Seattle. Judith H. Dern is the author. And I think it's a fun read. You know, I know for me personally, it's just reading a little bit of my own history here in this town. So it's fantastic and loved it. Thank you.
You are both in the book.
Good. Well, I'll have to come back and talk about some other things because I think the immigration thing, not only is it timely, but it's interesting in how we get to where we are today. Okie dokie. Barb Parrott from the Dahlia Bakery is here, and we're going to talk about Valentine's desserts. And Terry's going to give us a recipe maybe for something other than croque and bouche. And I'm going to tell you my favorite things for dessert on Valentine's Day. Thank you for being here in the Cairo Radio 97.3 studios of the Hot Stove Society. We are back in the Seattle kitchen here from the Hot Stove Society. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And Barb Parrott is joining us. Sarah's sitting in for KDO today. Barb Parrott is here from the Dahlia Bakery.
Hello.
We always have Brittany Bartleben for the Baker's Corner. She bakes all the pastries and things that you actually sell.
I quality control.
You quality control.
Yes.
Well, you need to eat more because you're too skinny then.
for somebody who quality controls, you must be skipping on
your
job.
I've been doing it for a long, lot of years.
So it's Valentine's, which was one of our biggest days at the bakery, not only for sales, that's obviously awesome, but it's also because it's a fun, romantic day.
It's
a lot
super
of people
fun.
Come in with lots of intentions in mind. You know,
exactly.
Take something home for their lovers, make someone feel better. You know, it's a little bit different than, say, a Thanksgiving or a Christmas day at the bakery, right? It's just more romantic.
It definitely is. And you see lots of people coming in and they're just excited about all the possibilities and trying new fun things.
Yeah.
So.
Fun. So what are some things that we're going to do this year that you think would make good Valentine's presents? Not only things that they could get out of our bakery, but maybe even try making at home themselves.
For sure.
Or finishing at home.
Britt has a hot date cake, which is a medjool date sticky toffee cake. And it's got a little banana chantilly cream on it, and mm-hmm. that is super fun. That would be perfect for sharing, I feel like.
I don't get that. Let's go back to that for a second. Chef, what do you think about this?
I got to understand the whole thing. So it's a cake with dates?
It's a medjool date sticky toffee cake, uh-huh. and then it's soaked in Zaya rum, the hard sauce, mm-hmm, sure. and it's got banana chantilly cream on top.
Now, you had me until the banana chantilly.
Yeah, me too.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
I find that interesting, like... I would never think to do that.
Yeah, I'm super fussy and very picky about my baked goods. Uh-huh. And I thought it was going to be not amazing. Uh-huh. And I actually really like it.
And you love it.
Yeah.
Good.
Interesting. Yeah. So the date cake, this is a phenomenon. Is this happening in your world, too? Because you probably don't serve it because you're French. But whole sticky toffee pudding thing is a phenomenon worldwide.
Yeah.
Everywhere I go, I see it.
Yeah. Hmm. Is it gluten-free by any chance?
No. That one is not.
No.
I love it. I have it when I go to Scotland. I have it at the restaurant that I go to in north of Glasgow. But every restaurant has it in Scotland. But you're seeing it all the time. We have it at our bakeries. I served it at the catering I was doing the other night at UW Catering. Right. And people just dig it. And what essentially it's like it's a little bit like a gingerbread.
Yeah.
But then with pureed or at least not necessarily pureed, but
paste.
Broken up. Pasted dates in it, and very much, and you can go any direction.
Right.
Fresh ginger, you can go spices, mm-hmm. but typically
coffee glaze,
But typically, it is very unspiced. Like it's not right. like a spice cake. It's fairly plain, and the dates and the glaze, like the alcohol glaze, a whiskey glaze, or something like that, generally is as much spice as you get.
Yeah, I think you can play around with it a lot, which is nice. Mm-hmm. And texturally, it's really good.
Playing on a fruit that has not been as used in dessert as much as some other fruits. So I think people are always looking for new windows of opportunity. And I think dates is very hot right now.
Mm-hmm. And it's a natural sugar.
Who doesn't like a hot date?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Especially on Valentine's. Yeah,
exactly.
Do you add more sugar to a date cake or does the sugar come from the dates themselves?
Typically, I would say it's coming from the dates.
Okay. Yeah, they're very sweet.
Yeah, because when I've heard about using dates in baked goods, it's as like a substitute if mm-hmm. you don't want mm-hmm. regular sugar in them anymore. Yeah.
All right, what else should people try on Valentine's?
The Bûche d'Amour, which is our chocolate.
Oh, it's like the Bûche de Noël, but for Valentine's Day.
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah. So this one is a flourless item. It is a chocolate roulade cake. It's a chocolate chiffon cake with an raspberry mascarpone. And then we coat it with a chocolate glaze. And... it's got some almond praline on top, and that is a lovely, I would say it's very decadent, and it would serve two people for a number of days, uh-huh. probably.
And so it looks like a jelly roll, or is there a heart shape, or what is it?
It looks like a jelly roll.
Okay.
And then there's little fondant hearts on top.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you put some little hearts everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's kind of cute. Yeah, no, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, Terry, that is just like a
Bûche de Noël.
Bûche de Noël.
Yeah.
Just same thing, but... decorated differently.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I get the idea and put more raspberries maybe.
Exactly.
Which is not really in season, but it's the one you put in the freezer from last year.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get it.
We're back in season now.
We're back in season.
Or I would say, you know, my wife makes these beautiful brandied cherries from the cherry crop every year. And this time of year, I'm always trying to use up some of this because we're not far off. I mean, June... 4 months, we're back in the cherry season, so you have to start looking at what's in your cupboard that you so dutifully filled and starting to use that stuff up before the next season comes around.
Ma chérie, mon amour.
What does that mean?
You love your cherry, you know. Chérie, you know the French word for darling?
Yes. My chérie?
Yeah, ma chérie. Yeah. Yeah. So cherry, you know, it's close.
It's always good when we go into French versus English grammar on the show.
Well, I didn't quite hear it, so I just didn't know. But I feel the same.
Yeah.
I love you, too.
Oh, thank you, darling.
What else you got for me?
My favorite, which has been my favorite for years and years, this is not for sharing. It's our creme brulee.
Uh-huh.
And it's an individual size. We can torch it to order in the bakery, which is one of the first things I learned to do when I started 10 years ago, which is terrifying, playing with blow torches.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's super fun. And
just teach your kids how to do it. That's much better. Yeah.
Yeah, it's safety first.
I recommend if you've never made creme brulee using a blowtorch, finishing a creme brulee, I recommend you don't do that for the first time at home on Valentine's Day. It could turn out really bad. That's how you end up in the emergency room on Valentine's Day. Not a good idea.
It keeps it exciting.
Yeah, you know. Okay, yeah, definitely. Oh, my God, I thought she was going to die. The house was on fire.
And if you don't own a blowtorch at home and you're buying one and you want to finish it off at home, can you just put it in your broiler? Mm-hmm. Is that how you would finish it?
You yep. do. No. The problem with that is many people's they leave it under there too long and it curdles the top of your creme brulee because yeah. the whole thing gets too hot before the sugar actually caramelizes. So
yeah, it's not really, it's not really a good... You will end up okay. with some brulee on top, but you will cure all your flan no matter what because it just doesn't get that hot that fast.
Would there be a better way to do it at home, if not via the broiler? You're just kind of stuck.
Well,
if you have a piece of... the old style of creme brulee was done with a piece of iron that you would put on the fire and get super, super hot, and then you would stamp on the sugar, and that would caramelize the sugar. That's the original recipe, the original long time ago. That's how they used to do it. But... yes, that's what I would do if you didn't have a choice. But
it really does make a lot of smoke, too.
Right.
Yeah. Or sometimes if you get it hot enough, you can hold it above the sugar, and the molten iron will still do its job
right.
without putting it into the sugar. One of the things I'll say about our creme brulee, and I've been making this for many years, longer than you've probably been alive, Miss Barb Parrott. But the New York Times called my creme brulee possibly the best in the world.
Yeah.
Just saying.
I thought it was the creme caramel, not the creme
caramel.
Sorry. Oh, the caramel.
It's the same custard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just do it different, right?
Don't you say it on the menu anymore at the palace?
I just call it world famous.
You used to say world famous.
My
creme
team
caramel.
Says in your own mind. Yeah, I get
the only
no respect.
Place that matters.
Yeah. I get, how do you get respect around here?
Anyway, yeah. So just saying.
Yeah,
but creme brulee is a delicious, easy, simple.
So good.
Most people love that. So.
That's true.
So just to be clear, creme caramel has the sugar in the bottom.
Caramel
right?
is on the
and
bottom,
and then
yeah.
you cook the whole thing so it melts, and then creme brulee has just the custard in the bottom, and then you put sugar on top, and you put it under the
correct.
Torch or the broiler. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So it seems if you were doing one at home, maybe creme caramel would be the better one to cook
yes.
at home.
Except you have to get it out of the cup.
Fair. Yeah, that's
the
also
creme brulee,
an issue.
You don't have to get out of the cup.
Yeah, so, but you can do yeah, that before your guests get there. So if it falls on the floor, you know.
Just have some ice cream.
You just have to clean the floor.
Yeah.
All right. We have time for one more.
Oh, my gosh. I would go with a half dozen cookies to share. So you get two of the strawberry lemonade cookies, which
we
ones
just
that we're
had.
Sampling, which are my favorite cookies right uh-huh. now. And then two of the Romeo's Kiss, which is a snickerdoodle cookie. It's kind of like a whoopie pie, but with a little bit more crunch to the cookie. Uh-huh. And then chocolate filling. And then our Cupid's birthday cookie.
Which is Cupid's birthday?
Yeah.
And?
Which is a sandwich cookie. It's got vanilla buttercream in the center. And
nice.
Then all sorts of romantic, I don't know, sprinkles.
Do we have any? One year I remember we did fortune cookies where we got little lover's fortunes coming out of the, mm-hmm. the cookies. Just mm-hmm. saying. Super hot.
They're super hot.
Just too bad when you get the one. Too bad when you get the one that says, a dear friend's going to leave you soon.
I know.
You're like, dang.
I got the one that says, you know, being single isn't such a bad thing. But there's all kinds of good fortunes you can put in those cookies to really ruin a person's day.
That's exactly what you want to do
for.
On Valentine's
that
Day.
Is yeah. totally what Tom yeah. would spend his time doing.
It reminds me of my Easter, the time I spend at Easter on my eggs. All right. So, of course, there's many more things than that. I personally like the sugar cookie decorating kit. I think that's really fun, and it takes a lot of the work out. All the icing comes in little tubes already. It's mm-hmm. very simple, very easy. All right, up next, thank you, Barb Parrott.
Yeah.
We have the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge right here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. We've asked Leslie Kelly, former reviewer for the PI and for several papers around the country. Used to work at All Recipes. You've done so many things, I can't even keep track of them all. But now you're on a trek around the country in your RV with your husband.
That's right, going mobile.
Taking a little break back here in Seattle for 3 weeks before you head out to, did you say Colorado's next? Or?
New Mexico.
New Mexico.
Texas, Louisiana,
nice.
Florida.
All right, Sarah, what do you got for us?
All right, so Leslie, along with all those things, we're going to see how your food trivia is. We are playing our food trivia game. You guys know how it goes. You each get asked 5 questions. Whoever gets the least amount correct is the loser, and that loser has to pony something up. Mm-hmm. Terry, if you lose, what are you going to give away?
I'm going to give Branch for two. Who's our recipient today?
Our recipient today is Kara Luca, who had the sunchokes in her refrigerator.
I'm going to give her Branch for two at Luke on a Saturday or Sunday.
Sounds lovely. Tom, what are you going to give away?
Well, I'm sure I have to give something away for Leslie, too, so
true.
I'm going to be very careful. And I'm going to give away, since we had Barb Parrott on the show today, let's give away a $100 gift card to the Dahlia Bakery so you can treat your Valentine to something terrific.
You're going to have some nice stuff for Valentine's Day.
Yeah. I can pony up.
Really? You got something in mind?
I'm going to do some bacon from Bavarian Meats.
Oh.
Have you tried their new bourbon bacon?
I haven't.
Why not?
Because their original is awesome.
Well, that's true. But
I've been using it for 40 years.
The whiskey, they soak it in whiskey, and it sounds kind of weird, but it is really delicious.
Mm. Nothing weird about bourbon and bacon.
No, that's all you want, really.
Is it bourbon or whiskey? Is that the same thing?
No. It depends on what part of the country you're in. But
so is that a pound, or a pound of that bacon, or 2 pounds?
A pound of that bacon.
A pound of that bacon. There you go.
All right. That is a delicious-sounding gift from all of you. So who wants to get started on this trivia?
I just thought.
All right, Terry. Your first question. Which Southeast Asian fruit's smell reminds people, to put it mildly, of various stages of decay? Is it durian, mangosteens, or jackfruit?
Southeast Asian. I'm going to go with the first one.
Durian?
Yep.
You are correct. What are the two main ingredients of a dark and stormy cocktail?
Ooh. Hmm. Ooh, this is going to stump chef, I think.
I'm going to go with bourbon.
Ooh.
Wrong already?
Ooh.
Yeah,
okay. Tom, what is a dark
rum
stormy?
And ginger beer.
That's correct.
Oh, that, I would have definitely
Tom.
Not know that.
Yeah, nope.
I'll take that
not
one.
Add all my drinks.
Yeah, we'll add it onto your score for later.
Whatever
Tom.
Happened to good, you know, vodka and tonic? Two ingredients, let me
What's
see.
What's the matter with dark rum and ginger beer? All right, your third question. Breed River Valley is a wine-producing region in which country? And I can give you some options if you want them.
Okay, go ahead.
Argentina, South Africa, or Spain?
I'm going to go with South Africa.
That is correct. It is indeed. All right, well, you've got 2 out of 3 so far. Let's see how far you'll go. In a carpet bag steak, what are placed into a pocket cut into the meat?
Oysters is the answer.
That is correct.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's when you don't have time to make an appetizer. You put everything in one place.
Shove some oysters in college.
We don't do oysters, then steak. We just put everything on one plate.
Yeah. Surf and turf.
Yeah.
All right, your final question, Terry. Let's see if you can get 4 out of 5. Which gas is produced when bread is baked and the yeast converts the fermentable sugars present in the dough?
I would say methane. That's not right.
It's not right,
that's
no.
That's not right. Because that makes absolutely no sense.
Somebody's going to get brunch.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. Another diffuser.
Carbon dioxide?
Carbon
dioxide. That is correct.
That was the answer.
Yes. You're just giving away the
I just wanted to get some diffuser.
Yeah, got to have some to take home. All right, who is going next? Terry got 4 out of 5 correct. That's the number to beat.
Okay. No, Terry got 3 out of 5, and I got 2 assistants.
You go. Yeah. All right.
I'll go.
All right, Leslie. What is the national dish of Hungary?
Goulash.
That is correct.
Bada boom.
Oh,
she's killing it.
Take your time.
Yeah, take your time.
Boom, boom.
Make it sound like it's difficult a little bit. Jeez.
All right, which came first, McDonald's or KFC?
KFC.
It's actually McDonald's.
Uh-oh. Oh, dear.
Uh-oh.
It opened in 1940. KFC opened in 1952.
Some doubt is creeping into her confidence
right
now.
All right.
This is where it starts going downward. Which Swedish word, beginning with the letter S, is a term for a buffet-style meal with a selection of hot and cold dishes?
Dishmorgisbord.
Yeah.
Wow, extra credit for the accent.
By the way,
I am Swedish.
Hey, by the way, my questions were hard. How are yours?
I'm sorry. You got enough help.
I have not given any diffusers away.
Mine needed assistance.
All right, Navarine is a type of French stew, including which type of meat?
Mm, can I get some
choices? Lamb, rabbit, or beef?
I'm going to say rabbit.
It's actually lamb.
Navarin d'agneau.
Bah, humbug.
Okay. I'm a big
loser.
Right.
You can still tie with Terry. You've got 3 out of 4 correct. So your
all
final
right.
question. Which animal's milk is used in pecorino cheese?
Sheep.
That is correct. You and Terry have indeed tied. So, Tom, let's see if you can beat it with a perfect score.
So they got 4 out of 5 each?
They each got 4 out of 5, yes. Right. We're counting Terry's helped questions.
Of course, he had to pay.
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
I've paid for
it costs
cheaters.
Me money.
Yeah.
I've paid for cheaters all the time.
That's how it goes. All right, Tom, let's see if you need to do it again.
Okay.
Which meat dish literally translates from Italian as jumps in the mouth? I have some options for you. Is it cannellini, saltimbocca, or cesarei e tria?
Yeah, I don't know.
Jumps in the mouth.
Jumps in the mouth.
Saltimbocca is a shank. Cannellini beans are not a meat. And so I'll go with the jumps in the mouth. I'll go with the etria, whatever that.
Saltimbocca.
Saltimbocca?
Yeah. Saltimbocca was the answer. But that was not what you said. So good try. You said the you said cesarei e tria, right?
Yeah. Well, if that's the way you heard it, but I said I thought I said saltimbocca.
All right, audience, what do you think? We're gonna put it up to you. Does he get it or no?
No, I didn't get it. That was a joke.
All right. From which country does Gouda cheese originate?
Denmark.
Holland.
Holland. Same thing.
Holland, the Netherlands. Yes.
You get that, Tom?
Yes, we'll give you that one.
You're saying it's not the same thing?
It's not.
But it's not the same country for sure.
No. So I'm 0-2.
It's around there. All right.
They are a few miles apart too.
Okay. We'll do the. No, Tom, that was not correct. So that is 0-2 for now. Warwickshire Drooper, Mirabelle, and Belle de Louvain are all varieties of which fruit? Plum, pears, or peaches?
I thought they were all cheese, so I guess I'm out.
Plum. Tom, just do plum.
It is correct, yes.
Yay! One!
Didn't even have to pay. All right.
How was your save line?
That was my lifeline.
Which two gases are contained within canned and draught Guinness, causing the beer's creamy head when poured?
Nitrous oxide.
Nope, but it was nitrogen and carbon dioxide.
So, I believe mean, that's a little...
Kind of close.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not going to count it, though.
Katie would have given that to me.
That's why.
Not.
This is what happens when Katie's not here.
I know, exactly.
Which cocktail is made by mixing Scotch whiskey and Drambuie?
I know. Rusty Nail?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that is.
Yeah.
So, Tom, that is 2 out of 4 correct, which unfortunately does make you the loser. So congratulations to our winner. They are getting that $100 gift card to Dahlia Bakery.
A little Valentine present. Yeah. If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. This show is produced by LARJ Media. Our lead producer is Sarah Leibovitz, and our sound engineer is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. If you want to be part of our studio audience, go to HotStoveSociety.com and buy a ticket for only $15. Comes with breakfast. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great week.